troops in the field and raise domestic support for our overseas action. The whole event was going to center around the ringing of the Freedom Bell, which would be symbolic of American democracy and freedom ringing out around the world. Must have sounded good to Congress because they approved it and hired some woman to make the new bell, and she was supposed to be a descendant of the British metalsmith who'd cast the original Liberty Bell. My task force team was one of over a dozen similar groups that were supposed to be on site during the festivities, though overall security was naturally a Secret Service gig. We were basically thugs in suits for the day, just in case bin Laden showed up with 100 pounds of C4 strapped to his chest. Life in post-9/11 America. Happy holidays. Bring the whole family. I switched off the set and closed my eyes. What was it Church had said?
Mr. Ledger, we are very much in the business of stopping terror. There are threats against this country greater than anything that has so far made the papers.
No kidding, I said aloud. So how did I work this? I'm self-aware enough to know that I have a somewhat fractured personality. Not exactly multiple personality disorder, but clearly there were different drivers at the wheel depending on my mood and depending on my needs. Over the years, I've been able to identify and make peace with the three dominant personalities, the modern man, the warrior, and the cop. At the moment, all three of them were trying to grab the wheel. The modern man, the civilized part of me, was in full-blown denial mode. He didn't want to believe in monsters, and he wasn't all that comfortable with secret government departments and all that James Bond crap. The warrior was okay with the cloak and dagger stuff because it partly defined him. It allowed him the chance to be who and what he was. A killer. He was useful in a firefight, but I seldom let him out to play. He was lousy at tea parties. Then there was the cop. That part of me had become dominant over the last few years, and he also upheld the nobler parts of the warrior's personality. The codes of ethics. The rules. With my eyes closed, I settled back into meditative breathing and let the parts of me sort it all out. It was almost always the cop who got the others to shut the hell up. The cop was the thinker. I dismantled this thing bit by bit and laid everything on the table so the cop could take a good long look. There were parts that didn't fit. The most obvious was the fact that the terrorists we took down at the warehouse had been such a mixed bag. These guys aren't known for tolerance and team spirit. The suicide plan was also weird. Each of the hostiles at the warehouse had been infected by a disease and had to take regular doses of an antidote to stay alive. That was impressive, but it also seemed like overkill. It was too sophisticated for its own purposes, considering that the mere threat of it should have been enough. It also spoke of a degree of technological sophistication that was, as far as I could judge, beyond the reach of your average extremist cell. If this was all real, and if it turned out that the plague that created these walkers was developed by the same mind or minds that created the control disease, then the DMS might be facing an actual, real-world, mad scientist. In another mood, or perhaps on another day, that might actually be funny. Right now, it scared the hell out of me. Then there was Javad. Was he really dead? And somehow reanimated? Impossible? You bet. And yet I know what I saw.
From now on, Church had said, we may have to consider dead a relative term.
I found it hard to believe that Javad was the only infected person. There hadn't been a lab at the warehouse. Church had to know that, too, and I should have remarked on it. The oven timer dinged, and I opened my eyes. I took the pizza with me into the little nook off the kitchen where I had my computer. I ate a slice while it loaded. Then I got to work. The cop in me was in gear now. Church had said that if I looked, I wouldn't find anything about him or the DMS. I wanted to put that to the test. So I stayed up all night searching the internet. I did a search on the warehouse Church had been using, Baylor Records Storage. To dig deep, I had to log on through the department website, and there was a serious risk in that. Everything is logged. Everything is tracked. Screw it, I said, and kept going. But Baylor Records turned out to be a dead end. Previous owner was dead, and there were no direct heirs, so the government had snapped it up for back taxes. Easy enough for someone like Church to commandeer. I searched all night to see if there was any connection between Baylor Records and the old Container Company warehouse where we'd taken down the terrorist cell, but if a connection existed, I couldn't find it. Early Sunday morning, Rudy called to say he'd spent all of last night and this morning researching prions. What happened to leave it alone, Joe?
What can I tell you? He said tiredly. So we both need therapy.
You find anything interesting?
Lots, but none of it germane to what you mean.
The whole prion thing seems less and less likely, though. As dangerous as they are, the infection rate is extremely slow. It can take months or years for it to manifest. I'll keep looking, though, and don't forget about our session on Tuesday.
Yes, Mother.
Don't start with me, cowboy, he warned and hung up.
The rest of Sunday went like that. I logged hour after hour on the net, and Rudy and I shared URLs via email and IM. But we didn't seem to be getting any closer to an explanation for what Javad was or how he came to be like that. Around midnight, I finally shut off the machine, took a shower, and shambled off to bed. I was hitting brick walls everywhere I went, and I guess another person would have thrown in the towel, but that's not my sort of thing. I just needed to rest and then attack this again with a fresher set of wits. Chapter 16 Galt and Amira, The Bunker, 6 days ago. They lay exhausted on the table, their clothes tangled around her waist and his ankles, his body purple and red with claw marks and bites. He never left a mark on her, not even the smallest of love bites. That would be suicide. They never spoke of love afterward, never told each other how much this meant or how much they meant to each other. They already knew what the other would say. It had all been said in that first moment of eye contact. Pillow talk would limit the feeling. It would define what did not need to be defined, and therefore cheapen it all to some kind of clandestine Romeo and Juliet pap. This was much bigger, and Galt hoped, likely to end with less personal tragedy. She spoke first, saying simply,
"I've had some vague reports. Baltimore?"
Yes, he drawled. Seems our warehouse is a total loss.
What about Javad?
He paused, staring at the speckled surface of the acoustic ceiling tiles, deciding which version of the truth to tell her. He loved Amira, but there were levels of privacy that even she didn't get to enter, which would make it easier if he had to kill her one of these days. He liked to keep his options open.
Uncertain.
He hasn't gotten out. I've been tracking the news feeds.
I know, which means that we still have to move forward with the next few steps of the operation.
What about the other two locations? If the Americans know about the warehouse...
Don't worry, Galt said. They know about one of them, the big one, but not about the other one. Right now they're holding off, probably hoping to find where the other lorry went.
She nodded, the motion massaging his bicep, which was starting to fall asleep.
When will you evacuate the plant?
Why bother? We don't really need it anymore, and I'm rather hoping they raid it.
Amira turned her head sharply.
Why?
How, why, and when they raid that plant will tell us a great deal about their intelligence gathering, and their wits.
Shouldn't those details be handled by your American friend?
He's too close to it to risk any direct involvement. Besides, Galt said, there's something else I need him to focus on. There are some indications that there is another player in the game.
possibly a new counter-terrorism organization or department. Right now this is just guesswork, but it bears looking into. Amira sat up and her black robes fell down to cover her with an unintentional display of rumpled modesty. She pushed a strand of glossy black hair away from her face. Without the chaudhry, her face was incredibly beautiful. Full lips, high cheekbones, a broad, clear brow, and those eyes. Galt loved those eyes. Like a falcon or some creature out of myth.
Is it the Brits? You think Barrier is?
He shook his head. No, not Barrier. Something the Yanks have cooked up, but as I said, I'm not sure who yet. I have feelers out through Homeland, the FBI, a few other agencies. If I'm right, then they'll show their hands soon enough.
You should put your pet monkey on it. He's tenacious.
Galt smiled. His name is Toys. And yes, he is tenacious. In fact, Galt thought, he'd love to cook you over a slow fire.
So, what are you going to do about the plant?
I rather think I'm going to let them raid it. I can't think of a better way of inspiring useful fear than letting me break in and see what's going on in that place. It'll do us worlds of good.
But what about El Mujahid? He's the master of creating fear, and his mission is already in the works. If you allow the raid on the warehouse, does that mean you'll use that instead of what my husband is?
Hardly, Galt assured her. I'm relying on the fighter to deliver the master stroke. But a raid on the plant will surely set the atmosphere, after which everything will go exactly as we want. She frowned at him, chewing a lip as she considered this. He knew that she was sorting through the possible outcomes based on what she knew, what he'd allowed her to know. She would come to very logical conclusions, and on the whole they would be right, but they would be incomplete. Which was fine.
Don't worry, my princess, Galt said, and turned on to his side so he could stroke her hair and brush the back of his hand against her cheek. This is going very, very well for us. We need the Yanks to think they're containing the situation. If they have a new special operations group, then it will help focus attention in the right direction for us. The best manipulations are always those in which the Mark thinks he is in charge.
Amira kissed him. You have the mind of a scorpion, my love.
Now, what do you have to show me? Her eyes lit up.
If creating great fear is what you want, then you'll be very happy with what we've done since the last time you were here.
As good as Javad?
Oh, no. This is much, much better.
He almost said, I love you. Instead, he kissed her deeply and passionately, and then whispered in her ear,
Show me.
Chapter 17. Baltimore, Maryland, Monday, June 29th, 6:03 a.m. Next morning I called a friend who worked early shift at DMV Records and asked her to run Buckethead's plates, but that went nowhere. No such plates existed. Big surprise. I logged back onto the department server to reread the task force report on the warehouse. It was gone. Completely gone. No file name, no incident folders, nothing.
You bastard, I said aloud.
Church had impressed me before, but now he was beginning to scare me. He threw enough weight to be able to locate and remove the official records of Homeland Security's Interjurisdictional Counterterrorism Task Force. That meant accessing local, state, and federal computer mainframes. Holy shit. There was a hard copy of the report in my desk at the squad room, but I had doubts that it would still be there if I went in to get it. This wasn't helping my feelings of paranoia. I turned and looked around my apartment. How aggressive would these guys be? Surely they wouldn't. 1 second later, I was searching my apartment from top to bottom, looking for microphones, phone bugs, fiber optics, surveillance threads. I looked hard, and I looked everywhere. I found nothing. That didn't mean there was nothing to find, though. Homeland and that whole crew had a lot of very sneaky toys that were designed not to be found. All the search resulted in was a 2-degree drop in my paranoia and an itchy spot between my shoulder blades like someone had a laser sight on me. Cursing under my breath, I headed into the bedroom to put on a suit in preparation for the OIS hearing, but as I was picking out a tie, the phone rang. I snatched it up, thinking it was Rudy.
Detective Ledger, this is Keisha Johnson.
I recognized her voice. She was the lieutenant overseeing the officer-involved shooting investigation for the task force raid. I thought about the searches and calls I'd made, despite Church's warning to stay away from this, and had a brief panic attack.
Yes, I said cautiously, hard in my throat.
In your absence, we reviewed all of the videotapes from the raid last Tuesday, and after several discussions with your commanding officer and the supervisors for the task force, we've concluded that your shooting was in keeping with the best policies and practices of the Baltimore Police Department, and no further hearings or actions will be required at this time.
I said something clever like, what?
Thank you for your willingness to cooperate, and good luck at Quantico. We'll be sorry to lose such a fine officer. And with that, she hung up.
I stared at the phone in total shock. There was no way that an OIS hearing would be handled like this. Not ever. Not even if everyone involved agreed that the shooting was completely righteous. Department policy mandated a hearing, token or not. This was weird, and I didn't like it one damn bit. The paranoia was back stronger than ever. But the logic was all twisted. If I'd somehow rattled Church's cage by trying to find some answers, why would he smooth the way for me by canceling the hearing? I couldn't see the advantage to him in it. I sat back down at my computer and pulled up the list of URLs Rudy had sent on prion diseases. Maybe that would give me a direction to follow, and I spent hours buried in science that was beyond me, but not so far beyond that it couldn't scare me. I learned that prion diseases are still very rare, about 1 case out of 1 million people worldwide, and only about 300 cases here in the States. It was rare, but seriously dangerous, and the mysteries surrounding the little buggers often led to panic reactions. The whole mad cow thing was prion disease at its worst, and the haste with which tens of thousands of cattle were slaughtered showed the degree of fear associated with the threat. Not that any of this helped. I'm pretty darn sure Javad didn't get the way he was from eating a bad McBurger. Then I clicked on another of Rudy's URLs, which took me to an article on a prion-based disease called Fatal Familial Insomnia, in which a small group of patients worldwide suffered increasing insomnia, resulting in panic attacks, the development of odd phobias, hallucinations, and other dissociative symptoms. The whole process takes months, and the victim generally dies as a result of total sleep deprivation, exhaustion, and stress. I searched all around the topic, and though there was no connection at all to a state resembling living death, the concept stuck in my head. Unending wakefulness. No sleep. No rest. No dreams. Jesus. It was a horrifying thought, and what a terrible way to die. Could Church have been wrong? Was Javad actually suffering from a disease whose symptoms led the doctors to believe he was dead when maybe he was really in a coma? His coming back from the dead could have been nothing more sinister than waking up from a cataleptic coma. Some part of that felt right to me, but as I read on, I hit another speed bump. Several of the sites said that the victims could not be put to sleep, not even through artificial means. They didn't lapse into a terminal coma at the end of their suffering. They died, and apparently stayed dead. Besides, even if Javad had been in some kind of walking catatonia, it didn't explain how he'd shrugged off the 245s I'd put in his back. Clearly, there was too much of the picture that I couldn't see, and it was maddening.
Chapter 18. Grace, Maryland. Monday, June 29th, 8:39 a.m. Grace Cortland sat in her comfortable leather swivel chair and sipped a Diet Coke, and watched the 8 color monitors that showed the inside of Joe Ledger's car, each room of his apartment, and the consulting room in Dr. Rudy Sanchez's office. She'd been amused when they'd each searched for bugs. None of them had found anything, of course. If they had, someone on her staff would lose his job. For what the DMS paid for holographic relay technology, it had better not show up on a sweep or be visible to the naked eye. The DMS had deep pockets, and Mr. Church liked having toys that no one else in the schoolyard had. Her desk was stacked with reports on Ledger. Bank account records, tax returns, school transcripts, his complete military record, and copies of everything filed about him since he joined the Baltimore police. She'd read it all, but Joe Ledger was still a puzzle. There were so many things about him that made him excellent material for the DMS, and Grace was finding it harder and harder to hold to her position that Ledger was a screw-up. If it wasn't for that damning evidence on the task force duty log. That morning, she'd read through Ledger's military service file. He had scored high marks in every area of training and had excelled in close-quarters combat, surveillance and counter-surveillance, land warfare, and all immediate action drills. There were several letters recommending Ledger for OCS, but each included notes saying that Ledger had declined the offer.
One handwritten note from Colonel Aaron Greenberg, base commander at Fort Bragg, read,
"Staff Sergeant Ledger has indicated that his goal is to use his Army training to better prepare him for a career as a law enforcement officer in his hometown of Baltimore, Maryland. I expressed to him that this was a gain for Baltimore PD, but a real loss for the Army." It was a pretty remarkable letter, but she chose to interpret it as a lack of ambition. What really caught her attention, though, was the transcript of a deposition of Ledger's company commander, Captain Michael S. Costas. Following the warehouse raid, Church had sent agents to depose Costas under oath and after signing a secrecy agreement. Costas spoke freely and glowingly about Ledger, but one exchange in particular must have struck Church. It was the only section highlighted in yellow. DMS. "Captain Costas, in your professional opinion, do you believe Joe Ledger to be reliable?" Costas. "Reliable? That's a funny question. Reliable in what way?" DMS. "If he were to become part of a special branch of the military?" Costas. "You mean like Homeland, something like that?" DMS. "Something like that, yes." Costas. "Let me put it this way. I've been in the Army since I was 18 and a Ranger since I was 20. I've been in combat in the MOG and in Desert Storm. I've also served in training schools for Rangers, and I've learned to trust my judgment on which men are going to become very good and which are likely to be only passable." DMS. "And it's your belief that what, that Ledger was one of those who would become very good?" Costas. "Hell, I knew that about him before he went to Ranger school. No. What I saw in Joe during his time in my company is that he was going to be great. Not good, but truly great. You don't see his kind very often, not unless you've been in a lot of war zones. I have been in a lot of war zones, and I can tell you right now that Joe Ledger is a hero waiting to happen." DMS. "A hero?" Costas. "Trust me, if you can inspire him, if you can tap into the core of that man, into what he believes, then by God he'll show you things you've never seen in another soldier. I guarantee it."
"Hero indeed," Grace muttered, turning up her nose at Costas's effusiveness. But as she immersed herself in Ledger's life, something shifted inside of her. She reread it, then slapped the report cover shut. Bollocks.
Ledger was a good fighter, that much was certain. But with all the DMS had to face, could they risk having someone like him aboard? The soldier in her wanted to have nothing to do with him, and yet the woman in her wasn't so sure. On the screen, Ledger hammering away at his computer keyboard, his face intent, his blue eyes bright and... "Stop it, you stupid cow," she said aloud, and turned away from the screen for a moment. This was counterproductive bullshit. This was a side effect of being alone in a lonely job in a foreign country. This was hormones and biology, and that was all. But when she turned back to the screen, Joe's eyes were still as blue. She punched a button that brought up an internet display screen that mimicked whatever Ledger was looking at, and Grace forced herself to concentrate on the prion information he was reading. The dry complexity of the medical information was a relief, and she could feel the small flare of emotionality subside within her. Grace sipped her Diet Coke and slammed the can down on her desk. There was no way she was going to approve him coming on board. No way in hell. Chapter 19. Mr. Church, Maryland, Monday, June 29th, 8:51 a.m. Mr. Church sat back in a heavy leather chair, taking occasional sips from a bottle of spring water. The wall in front of him was covered floor to ceiling, with video monitors. One screen showed Dr. Rudy Sanchez taking notes in his private office, while a patrol sergeant broke into tears as he confessed an ongoing love affair with a precinct secretary that his wife had now started to suspect. Church paid no attention to the cop, but he studied Sanchez very closely. He selected a vanilla wafer from a dish and bit off a piece. Another screen showed Joe Ledger bent over his computer, and as he typed, the keystrokes were displayed in a digital text bar below the screen. But what interested him most was the screen on the upper left side of his display board. On that one, Grace Cortland was sipping a Diet Coke and staring with great apparent fascination at Joe Ledger. The camera he had installed in her office was something not even she would find. It was two or three generations above the equipment she used, and her stuff was cutting edge. Church had better sources. He watched her face, the shape of her mouth, the shift of her eyes as she watched Joe Ledger. Church chewed his cookie. Even if anyone had been there, his face would have given away none of his thoughts. Chapter 20. Baltimore, Maryland, Monday, June 29th, 9:17 a.m. I decided to come at this from a different route, so I called Jerry Spencer, my friend from DCPD, who'd gotten his sternum cracked at the warehouse. Jerry was 30 years on the job and was the best forensics man I ever met. If anyone had caught a whiff of this DMS thing, it'd be him. He answered on the fifth ring. "Jerry, hey man, how's the chest?" "Joe," he said. No inflection. "How are you? You still out on medical?" Or he cut me off. "What do you need, Joe?" His tone was matter of fact, so I decided to be straight with him. "Jerry, have you ever heard of a federal agency called the DMS? There was a long silence on the line, and then Jerry said, "No, I haven't, Joe. And neither have you." Before I could work out a response to that, he hung up. "Uh-oh," I murmured, and for the next 10 minutes all I did was sit there and stare at the phone. Jerry had been gotten to. A blind man could see that. It strained my head to imagine how much force it would take to spook a guy like Jerry enough to have him blow me off like that. Cobbler jumped into my lap and I stroked his silky fur while I chewed on the problem. Until now, I'd hesitated doing a direct search on the DMS for fear of that acronym or the words Department of Military Sciences setting off some kind of alarms. For a while now, the government has used different software packages to locate certain combinations of words in email or net searches. Type in something like bomb and school, and it's supposed to raise a red flag.
Doing this kind of search could land my ass in a sling. On the other hand, how could I just leave this be? How could Church expect me to forget it? Even if Church was right and the whole Javad, Prion, Walking Dead thing was over, a one-shot fluke that we lucked into and solved before it got out of the box, that still didn't alter the fact that the incident changed my whole world. Now I know how those folks feel who see a UFO or Bigfoot. Not the nutcases, but the ones who are absolutely sure they've seen something outside of normal reality and have nowhere to go with it. What would happen if I did that search? I mean, what would Church really do as a result? I met the man, and even though I could see him feeding a busload of orphans and nuns to hungry wolves if it furthered his aims, I didn't take him for petty vindictiveness. So what would he do if I did a search on Department of Military Sciences? "Kiss my ass, Church," I said, and hit the enter key. I got a few hits for college ROTC programs under that name, but in terms of national security or secret agencies, absolutely nothing came up on the search. A waste of time? Maybe. Or maybe I had lobbed a serve into Church's court.
Chapter 21. Galt and Amira. The Bunker. 6 days ago. The Level A PVC hazmat suit was air-cooled and very comfortable, but Galt still felt like a big marshmallow. He stood close to the airlock. In one hand, he held a wireless remote that would trigger the emergency release on the lock in case he had to make a run for it. In the other, he held a Snellig 46, an electric wire dart pistol. Amira stood behind a plexiglass wall, and her fingers hovered over a computer keyboard.
"What stage is it in?" Galt asked. Their suits were soundproofed, and the intercoms were of the best quality.
"Advanced Stage 1."
Galt cocked an eyebrow.
"It's still alive?"
The creature standing there certainly didn't look alive. The brown skin had faded to a sickly bruise yellow. Its mouth was slack, lips gray and rubbery. It was only when Galt shifted a few feet to one side, in order to see the thing's eyes, that he could detect any trace of intelligence. But even then it was rudimentary.
"I resequenced the hormonal discharge to make the blood chemistry more hospitable for the parasites. They spread the prions at a much more accelerated rate now. The non-essential functions shut down more quickly,"
Amira said brightly.
"Higher brain functions deteriorate at a faster rate now."
"How much faster?"
Amira paused and turned and flashed him a triumphant smile.
8 times.
He frowned.
"This is Generation 3?
She laughed.
"Oh no, Sebastian. We've passed that phase a long time ago. What you're seeing is Generation 7 of the Saif al-Din pathogen. We've broken through almost all of the symptomatic barriers."
Galt's head whipped around as he stared at the subject, then up at the big wall clock.
7? Christ!
When was infection begun?
Right before I came to meet you.
Galt licked his lips.
That's... what, an hour?
She shook her head.
Less. 47 minutes. And I think we can get that down even more. That rate is based on injection only. We added a new parasite to the salivary glands, so infection from bites is much faster. A matter of minutes. By Generation 8, we should have it down to seconds.
The creature shook its head like an animal shaking off a biting fly. The hazmat suits prevented the subject from hearing or smelling them, which were the two most significant response triggers. However, the sight of them was causing it to become agitated. Without human scent or sound, that hadn't happened with earlier generations. Galt moved his hand experimentally, wanting to see if the creature would track him. Suddenly it lunged. Without warning or hesitation, it threw itself at Galt, springing across the cold metal floor of the display area, hooked fingers clawing the air as it tried to grab him. Galt cried out and staggered back, but he brought up the Snellig and fired the weapon's twin flechettes into the monster's naked chest. He pressed his thumb down on the activator and sent 70,000 volts into the infected predator. The subject let out a scream like a cougar, high and full of hate, but it dropped down into a fetal ball, twitching as the current burned through it. "That's enough!" he heard Amira shout, and Galt sagged back, releasing the button. His chest was heaving and his heart hammering. Amira laughed as she came out from behind the plexi screen.
"The new parasite has enhanced predatory aggression by at least half, and it begins far sooner. Even from a non-fatal bite, the infection will take hold within minutes and begin reducing cognitive function. In cases of a more serious bite, or in the presence of other traumatic injuries, the infection will spread exponentially faster."
"He could have killed me," Galt snapped, rounding on her and pointing the Snellig at her chest.
For a white-hot moment, he almost pulled the trigger. But she was still laughing, shaking her head.
"Oh, don't be such an old woman."
She used the toe of one booted foot to pull back the creature's upper lip. Galt saw that the pale gums were smooth. Amira said,
"I had its teeth pulled in preparation for the demonstration. I'm not an idiot, Sebastian."
Galt said nothing for a moment.
His jaw locked, lips curled back from his teeth in as savage a snarl as he'd seen on the face of the subject.
Then, by slow degrees, he forced himself to let go of the moment. He made his face relax first and gradually straightened his body from the defensive crouch.
"You could have effing well warned me."
"That would have been less fun."
"God, you're a wicked bitch," he said.
But now he was smiling, too. It was completely artificial, but he made it look convincing, thinking, "You are so going to pay for that, my dear." Amira either couldn't tell how upset he truly was, or didn't care, and the hazmat suit hid most of his face. But she looked at the wall clock, and then walked back to her control console, pulling off her hood.
"The new hormone sequence has one more really marvelous effect," she said as she punched some keys.
There was a heavy metallic chunk as steel panels slid back on the floor. She hit another button, and four curved sections of inch-thick reinforced glass rose from the floor, their sides fit together with only a faintness of the seam visible. The glass walls hissed upward until they reached a large circular track in the ceiling. As the upper edges slid into the tracks, there was another chunking sound and the walls stopped moving. Amira watched the wall clock all the while. The subject lay in the center of a big glass and steel jar.
"Wait for it,"
she murmured as the digital counters ticked away the seconds.
"Should be right about now. Generation 7 is so wonderfully quick."
The creature suddenly opened its eyes and peeled back its lips to issue a hiss of animal hatred. No sound escaped the barrier, but Galt still flinched. Then he blinked and looked from the subject to the clock and back again.
"Wait," he said. "That doesn't..." Amira's gorgeous dark eyes sparkled with delight.
"Reanimation time is now under 90 seconds.
He tore off his hood and threw it onto a nearby console.
"God!"
he gasped, staring at the monster.
"If you were worried that the Americans might harvest one of our subjects for research, it doesn't matter now. They can have all of the subjects we've already sent, but any preventive measure they design will be built on the wrong generation of the disease."
She walked over and placed her palm on the glass, and even when the subject lunged at her and slammed its face against the inner wall on the other side, she didn't flinch. There was an adoring look on her face as she stared at the subject. Galt came to stand next to her. The subject kept banging against the glass, its infected brain unable to process the concept of transparency. Even without scent, it knew that its prey was there. That was the only thought it could hold on to. In an awed voice, Amira whispered,
"Once we release these new subjects, Into the population, the infection will spread beyond control. They won't be able to keep ahead of it.
Galt nodded slowly, but his mind was working at computer speed, putting everything he'd seen and everything Amira had said into context. It was an effort to keep his feelings about all of this off his face.
"This is unstoppable,"
Amira said with a predatory hiss in her voice.
"We can kill them all."
"Now, now," he said, wrapping his arm around her. "Let's not lose focus here. We don't want to kill them all, darling. What would be the point in that? We simply want to make them all very, very sick."
He stroked her breast through the hazmat material. She said nothing, but he saw her turn away as if to look at some gauges, and he was certain she was trying to hide her expression.
"You told me to continue with the research to improve the model. What do you expect me to do with everything I've developed? Just destroy it?"
"Yes, I bloody well do,"
he said, but then he stopped, lips pursed, considering. Then something occurred to him.
"Actually, hold on a bit."
She turned back to him, her face showing hurt and suspicion.
"What?"
"I have a wonderful idea," he purred. "I think I've figured out how to use your new monster. Oh, yes, this is both juicy and delicious."
Still frowning, she said,
"Tell me."
"Before I do, you have to promise me that you'll use it only as I suggest. We can't really let this generation of the pathogen out, not ever. You do understand that, don't you?"
She said nothing.
"Do you understand?"
He said it again, slowly, reinforcing each syllable.
"Yes, yes, I understand. You really are such an old woman at times, Sebastian."
"Dear heart, we want to buy the world, not bury it."
Amira gave him a slow three count, and then nodded.
"Of course,"
she said.
"I just wanted you to see what we could accomplish. We've created a new kind of life, an entirely new state of existence. Unlife."
He stepped back from her and stared, the devious smile still frozen onto his mouth.
"Unlife. God Almighty," he thought.
"Now, tell me your idea,"
she said, breaking through the shell of his shocked and fragile thoughts.
"How can you use my new pathogen to help us in our cause?"
And suddenly Galt was snapped out of his reverie and out of his shock, and was completely present in his mind. She had said, "cause," not program, not scheme or plan. "Cause." "That is a very interesting choice of a word, my love," he thought. So he told her, and he watched her face as she listened, and he paid special attention to the muscles around her eyes and the dilation of her pupils. What he saw told him a lot, perhaps too much, and it both elated him and hurt him. By the time he was done, her beautiful face was suffused with a terrible light. Amira pulled him close and wrapped her arms around him. They held tightly together, ignoring the absurdity of the PVC suits.
"I love you,"
she said.
"I love you too," he said, and meant it.
"And when this is done, I may have to feed you to one of your pets," he thought. And he meant that, too.
Chapter 22. Balkh, Afghanistan, 5 days ago. 1. The town of Balkh in northern Afghanistan was once one of the great cities of the ancient world. Now, even with a population of over 100,000, the town is largely in ruins. The Iranian prophet Zoroaster was born there, and for centuries it was the center of the Zoroastrian religion. Now, like much of Afghanistan,
It varies between poverty and desperation, with some rare spots of music, color, and the laughter of children too young to grasp the realities of the life that awaits them. South and a little east of the city is the small town of Bitar, a village caught like an eagle's nest in the spiky crags of a mountain pass. Only one serpentine road led up into it, and a worse one wound down. Camels manage it because they're stubborn, but even they slip once in a while. There are 86 people living in Bitar, most of them childless parents, whose sons have died fighting either for the Taliban or against them, or who have gone off to work the poppy fields and never returned. A few of the youngest children walk 7 miles to go to school. There are only 30 camels in the whole town. The chickens are all skinny. Only the goats look hardy, but they are a hardy breed, used to very little. For plumbing, the people have well water that smells of animal urine and old salt. Ekbal was 16, and his parents had not yet lost him to the poppy fields or the wars. Ekbal was destined to serve Allah through service to his family. It was his Qawm identity, he was sure, to be a farmer, and in that way both preserve old ways and yet provide for the future. Despite war and strife, Ekbal believed in the future, and to him it was bright with promise. Wars pass, but Afghanistan, graced by the love of Allah, endures. Every morning Ekbal would rise with the day, clean himself, and then dress in loose robes and place a kufi cap on his head, so that he would be ready to say his first prayers of the day, following the precise requirements of Salat. First standing and then kneeling, and finally prostrate in humility before the grace and majesty of God. Though a young man of uncomplicated faith and one who had dedicated himself to the simple rigors of the farm life there in the dusty desert, Ekbal was not a simple-headed youth. As he tended his flocks or did chores around the farm, he was often deep in complex thought, sometimes wrestling meanings out of the passages in the Quran, sometimes working to understand the complexities of delivering a breached goat without losing either mother or kid. He did not think fast, but he always thought deep, and when he came to a conclusion, he was generally correct. Had he lived, Ekbal would have very likely become the head man of the village, and certainly a man to be counted, but Ekbal did not live. Ekbal would not live to see his 17th birthday, which was 8 days away. "Ekbal," called his father, who was laid up with a broken ankle.
"How is that goat coming along?"
The young man crouched over the gravid goat, who was crying out in pain as Ekbal worked his hands inside the birth canal to try and turn the kid. The other goats picked up her nervousness, and the air was a constant barrage of snorts and baas. Ekbal's hands were red with blood and mucus, and sweat shone brightly on his face as he worked, brow knitted, his clever fingers feeling along the tiny legs of the unborn goat.
"I think I have it, father,"
he called as his fingertips encountered the soft, ropey length of the umbilical cord.
"The cord is twisted around the hind legs."
He heard the scrape of a crutch as his father shuffled toward the open window.
"Be gentle now, boy. Nature does not want you to hurry."
"Yes, father," Ekbal said.
It was one of his father's favorite sayings, and it matched the slow process of thought and action that made Ekbal his father's son. Patience was as valuable to a farmer as seeds and water. He curled one finger around the cord and gently, very gently, pulled it down and over the kid's legs, then felt inside to make sure that there was no other obstruction. With great care, he pushed on the kid to turn it inside the mother, who continued to bleat and cry.
"It's clear, father."
"Then step back and let her do her own work," his father advised, and Ekbal glanced up to see his father's face in the window.
He, too, was slick with sweat, the pain of his broken leg, shattered in a terrible fall on the cliffside, was etched into the lines on his face. His color was bad, but he was smiling at his son as Iqbal slowly withdrew his hand from the goat and sat back to watch. The bleating of the goat changed in pitch as the baby began to slide along the birth canal. It was still painful, but now the goat did not sound desperate, merely tired and sore. Within 2 minutes, the wet, slime-slick little body slid out of her and flopped onto the straw-covered ground. Immediately the mother struggled to her feet and began licking at it, sponging clear her baby's nose and mouth and eyes.
"A female, father,"
said Iqbal, turning again to look at his father. He froze, confused at the expression on his father's face. Instead of relief or joy, his face stared at him with an expression that was a twisted mask of shock and horror.
"Father?"
Then Iqbal saw that his father was not looking at him, but behind him. Iqbal whirled, thinking that it was one of the men from the Taliban group in the caves to the south, or a collector from the poppy farms come to take someone else off to work in the fields. Iqbal's hand was straying toward his shepherd's crook when he froze in place, and he could feel his own face contorting into lines of dread. A man stood behind him. No, not a man. A thing. It was dressed like a man, but in strange clothes, light blue pants and a V-necked, short-sleeved shirt. Iqbal had seen TV. He had been to the clinic in Balkh. He knew what hospital scrubs were, but he had never seen them out here. This man wore them now, and they were dirty and torn, and stained to a dark, shining purple wetness by blood. Blood was everywhere. On the man's clothes, his hands, his face, his mouth, his teeth. Iqbal heard his father scream, and then his whole world was torn in red madness and pain. 2. El-Mujahid sat comfortably in the saddle of his four-wheeled ATV, leaning back against the thick cushions, heavy arms folded across his chest. 300 yards up the slope, the screams were already starting to fade as the last of the villagers died. He did not smile, but he felt a strange joy at so much death. It had all worked so well and so quickly, far more quickly than the last time. 4 subjects, 86 villagers. He checked his watch. 18 minutes. His walkie-talkie crackled, and he thumbed the switch and held it to his mouth.
"It is done," said his lieutenant, Abdul.
"Are you tracking all 4 subjects?
"Yes, sir."
"And the villagers?"
5 have already revived," said Abdul,
and the fighter thought he detected a slight tremble in the man's voice.
"Soon they will all be up."
The fighter nodded to himself, content in the knowledge that Saif al-Din, the holy sword of the faithful, was in motion now, and nothing could deny the will of God. In the village, the rattle of gunfire seasoned the air, like music. Chapter 23. Baltimore, Maryland. Tuesday, June 30th, 9:11 a.m. I made it through the rest of the night and all through the morning without federal agents appearing to kick down my door. Days of searching for the DMS, Javad, the 2 trucks, and Mr. Church had gone exactly nowhere. I now knew way too much useful information about spongiform encephalitis, including mad cow disease and fatal familial insomnia, but I had nowhere to go with it. Hoorah for me! I took a hot shower, dressed in khakis and a Hawaiian shirt that was big enough to hide the .45 clipped to my belt, and then headed out to my appointment with Rudy. But first I had to stop at Starbucks and pick up his silly-ass drink.
"I'm sorry, Joe," said Kitty, the receptionist, when I arrived at Rudy's office. "But Dr. Sanchez didn't come back from lunch. I called his cell and his home number, but they go straight to his answering machine. He's not at the hospital either."
"Okay, Kitty, tell you what. I'm going to go swing by his place and see what's what. I'll give you a call if I find anything. You call me if he gets in touch."
"Okay, Joe,"
She chewed her lip.
He's okay, though, isn't he?
I gave her a smile. Oh, sure, could be any number of things. He'll be fine. Out in the hallway, my smile evaporated. Sure, any number of things could explain this. Like what? On the elevator down, I began to feel a little sick. Now was not a good time for Rudy to suddenly go missing. I thought about the message I'd probably sent to church via my internet searches and began to get a big, bad feeling in the pit of my stomach. I stepped out of his building and looked around the parking lot. His car wasn't there, not that I'd expected it to be. So I walked over to mine, clicked the locks and opened the door, and stopped dead. I had my gun out before I even fully registered what I was seeing. I spun around and scanned the entire lot, pistol down by my leg. My heart was a jackhammer. There were over 50 cars and half a dozen people going toward them or walking toward the building. Everyone and everything looked normal. I turned back to the front seat. There, on the driver's side, was a package of Oreo cookies. The plastic had been neatly sliced and one cookie was missing. In its place was one of Rudy's business cards. I holstered my gun, picked up the card, and turned it over. On the back was a note. Nothing complicated, no threats. Just an address that I knew very well, and one other word. The address was the dockside warehouse where I'd killed Javad the first time. The single word was now. Part 2. Heroes. Unhappy the land that is in need of heroes. Bertolt Brecht. Chapter 24. Baltimore, Maryland, Tuesday, June 30th, 2:26 p.m. It took 20 minutes to drive back to the docks, and I had murder in my heart. When I pulled up to the parking lot entrance, I slowed to a stop and stared. The place had changed a hell of a lot in the last few days. There was a brand new heavy-duty front gate that hadn't been there when we'd raided the place, and a chain-link fence topped with coils of razor wire. There was a second inner fence that looked innocuous except for the metal signs every 40 feet that read, Danger, High Voltage. I saw four armed security guards, all of them dressed alike in distinctly non-military uniforms. Some kind of generic guard-for-hire rig, but that didn't fool me. They all had the trained military look. There are certain levels of training you can't disguise with polyester sport coats and khaki slacks. I have to admit that I debated going in quick and dirty, knocking these guys on their asses and coming up on church out of a shadow. But I didn't. It was a cute thought, but not a good one, and it probably wouldn't do Rudy or me any good. So I drove right up to the gate and let them take a good look at my face.
May I see some identification, sir?
I didn't make a fuss, just flashed them my badge and picture ID. The guard barely looked at it. He already knew who I was. He waved me through and told me to park by the staff entrance on the far side. I did as instructed, aware that they were watching me, and in my side-view mirror, I caught a glimpse of a guard walking the perimeter of the roof. I strolled over to the door, taking only enough time to see other new features, like the tidy little security camera above the door and keycard lock. I didn't need a key, though, because the door opened before I could knock. Inside the entrance was one of the most striking women I'd ever seen. She had gold-flecked brown eyes and an athletic figure that looked hard in the right places and soft in the right places. Her hair was cut short, and she wore black fatigue pants and a gray T-shirt with no markings, nothing like DMS stenciled on the front. No sign of rank either, but her bearing was officer level. You could tell that right off. She had a Sig Sauer .9 in a shoulder rig, and the grips looked worn from hard use.
"Thanks for coming, Detective Ledger," she said in a London accent.
Her face showed signs of sleep deprivation and strain, and her eyes were red-rimmed as if she'd been crying. It could have been allergies, but under the circumstances, I didn't think so. I wondered what had happened to upset her.
Was it the same thing that had caused Church to send his invitation? Whatever it was, it didn't take a genius to get the idea that it wasn't good. The woman didn't offer her name, give me a salute, or want to shake hands. She also didn't ask me to surrender my piece. So I said, "Church."
"He's waiting for you,"